Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Patty James, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum, and it's now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Adam Ghazali. Adam Ghazali, MD, PhD, is a professor in neurology, physiology, and psychiatry at UC San Francisco and the founder, executive director of Neuroscape, a translational neuroscience center engaged in technology creation and scientific research of novel brain assessment and optimization approaches to impact education, wellness, and medicine practices. Dr. Ghazali is co-founder and chief science advisor of Akili Interactive Labs, a company developing therapeutic video games, and co-founder and chief scientist at Jazz Venture Partners, a venture capital firm investing in experiential technology to improve human performance. Additionally, he is a scientific advisor for over a dozen technology companies, including Apple, GE, Magic Leap, and Nielsen. He has filed multiple patents, authored over 100 scientific articles, and delivered over 500 invited presentations all over the world. He wrote and hosted the nationally televised PBS special, The Distracted Mind, with Dr. Adam Ghazali, and co-founded with Dr. Larry Rosen the MIT press book, The Distracted Mind, Ancient Brains in a High-Tech World. Be sure to pick up your copy in the lobby after the program that Adam will sign for you. Dr. Ghazali has received many awards and honors, most recently the 2015 Society for Neuroscience, the Science Education Educator Award. So welcome, Dr. Ghazali.
Hello, everyone. So many friendly faces here. I love it. Love it. Well, thanks for coming tonight. I'm excited to see all of you and to share with you a new talk, which is great because I give a lot of talks. So it's fresh for me to really share a topic that I have been studying for almost 20 years. And putting it all together has really been an effort of love and to bring it and outside of a book, outside of pages, and to put it face-to-face is fun for me. And so you might have noticed that I have a book by the same title as the talk today, but I want to make it clear that this is not a Cliff Notes version of the book. The book's over 200 pages, there's so much in there, but what I thought would be more interesting for you and for me is to really dive deep on some of the new theories and ideas that are raised in the book that I wrote with my co-author, Larry Rosen, who's a psychologist and really studies technology's impact on behavior while I study what happens inside the brain. So that's what I have planned for you today. So there will be a lot of information on these two screens over here, and hopefully we'll be able to go through them together, and then we'll have time for questions. So before I begin the brain bashing, I do want to point out that the brain is the most extraordinary structure in the entire universe, right? It is impressive in every way that you can look at it. It is an incredibly rapid information processor. On the order of tenths of seconds, it is allowing us to interpret information in a way that computers have not. It can store information 50 times the volume of information in the Library of Congress, connecting events over decades. And despite the fact that it lives in a rather small place, it is a massive structure, right? We know that there are close to 100 million neurons, which are on the order of stars in the core of the Milky Way galaxy. And what's even more impressive is that each of those neurons have 10,000 connections, putting it at hundreds of trillions of synapses in the brain, making a network of really staggering complexity. And despite this, you don't really have to hear all these brain facts to know how amazing the human brain is, right? Every emotion you feel, every thought you have, every sensation you experience, every breath you take, every move you make, the very core of your identity is an emergent property of the function of our brains. And despite that, we have some very fundamental limitations, asking us what happens when our brains meet this. Now, there is clearly, and I don't have to explain to this audience, that's the fun thing about presenting right here in Silicon Valley,
in the Bay Area is that there has been an explosion in both the diversity and accessibility of information technology, both on the hardware and software side. I mean, even as I was putting this slide together, there are things that just appeared, like, you know, in the last couple of weeks. And it's not that this technology is just available everywhere when you want to access information. It can ping you and share information with you when it's ready to as well. And so, you know, if you think about it, we've really seen not just an amazing display of innovation in tech, but an ushering in of a next level, next stage of the information age, where the ultimate commodity is information. And this is not so surprising, because at our core, we are information-seeking creatures. Evidence suggests that the very ancient reward systems of our brain that drove our ancient ancestors to forage for food for survival are now co-opted through evolutionary pressure for primates to forage for information. We forage for information much in the same way that other animals forage for food. And so if you look at our behavior and how we consume it, it's not so surprising how we multitask at such a, you know, with a voracious appetite. We know that 95% of people report multitasking at least once a day, and that it could be 30% of the time spent using technology is multitasking. It's even more so for younger generations, where some use up to 7 different devices and sources of information at the same time. And it's not just how we use our technology. It's when and where we use it. It has pervaded every domain in our worlds. It's in our restaurants, it's in our bedrooms, it's in our classrooms, it goes on vacation with us, and of course we know it is inside our cars. And so what I want to do now is dive deep into the brain and answer 2 questions. Why do we interact with our technology in this way, and what are the consequences of this behavior? In order to do that, we have to dial back the clock, right? So in the beginning, there were single-cell organisms, right? That's how that story begins. Now, the predecessor of the human brain and all brains really emerged from these creatures that didn't have a brain. And it emerged for one reason, because they had to learn to interact with their environment. Really, 2 main aspects of their environment, toxins and nutrients. And this led to the need to sense and to move, right? To avoid toxins and to seek out nutrients. And then, if you look with brain evolution, the same phenomenon was there. Of course, the environment became more complicated. And there was the introduction of mates, which really complicated the entire interaction with the world around us. Sensations became perceptions, which really interpretations of the world. Movements became more complicated actions. But it's really the same story as it was for single-celled organisms. The environment feeds information in that guides perception. This is known as bottom-up. Things that are very salient or very novel in the environment demand the perception processing, and that leads to actions reflexively. This changes the world. New perceptions leads to new actions. Actions lead to new perceptions. This is the perception-action cycle, and it is the core of how every brain works and always has worked. In most animals, this is really very reflexive. Behaviors might look very complicated, like ants following each other and traveling across the floor, or even something as amazing as an eagle or hawk diving down to grab a rodent. But most of what animals do is really a reflexive response, and they can be quite sophisticated, to the world around them. And so you have this cycle. Now, the biggest advance of the human brain has been to break this cycle, to pause. And in that pause, we insert our goals. We make decisions about how we want to act in the world. And that guides our actions through a process that's known as top-down. Top-down, so this is really the core. I mean, we're not the only animal that has top-down, but we're certainly the most sophisticated in how we deploy it. Top-down goals are what has allowed everything that humans have created, you know, civilization and technology and art and culture. Society, as we know it, is really driven by our ability to not be slaves to processing the world around us just based on how salient or how, you know, novel it is. We get to make decisions. But another fascinating thing about top-down is that it doesn't just act on our actions, it acts on our perception. Those flowers that you want to look at and smell are redder and they have better, you know, sweeter fragrance to you compared to those that you're ignoring. We process our worlds based on our goals, and this has really changed everything. And so, if we distill down what's a complicated slide to its core, you notice that little bottom-up cue there to get your attention that this is important. Everything that we do is an integration of top-down, goal-directed activity and bottom-up, environmental-driven. And if you think about your world, you will see that this is how we interact. And this is a very human aspect of interacting with the world. So the reason I put that little star there is this is the first place that I would say that technology has created a complication in our lives. This intersection between top-down and bottom-up, right? Bottom-up is, you know, if we didn't have bottom-up, we wouldn't be able to survive. You can't cross a street without hearing a car horn, even if it's outside of your goals. But technology, in the way that we just looked at, how it has permeated our lives and is always accessible at an unprecedented rate, has caused us to become more sensitive to bottom-up input. So we are driven more and more reflexively to respond to the world around us and less frequently to engage in it in a top-down way. So this is not where I want to get political, but I do have a piece, an op-ed piece coming out in Politica where I basically make the point that with this change, you could see it in many aspects of society. And I would say that if you look at the campaign on both sides, it is the shiniest, most bizarre, most noisy stimuli that grab our attention and remove us from the deep, slower process of top-down thought that should go into any decision of that magnitude. So this is something that you'll see throughout your lives, and I think that this is an area where technology has impacted us in a detrimental way. So let's move on and talk about goals, and you'll see there's another piece to this story. Goals have two parts. There's the goal setting, how we formulate goals in the first place, and then there's the goal enactment, how we carry out our goals. Goal setting is a set of abilities often called executive functions where we evaluate, we make decisions, we organize, we plan, we have a goal, and then we need to carry it out. A set of abilities that I classify under the umbrella of cognitive control, attention, working memory, and goal management. And I really want to pause here because this is everything when it comes to understanding the distracted mind, cognitive control. Attention is our ability to focus our very limited resources where we want them in space and time. Working memory is holding that information in mind once it's no longer present to guide our behavior. And what I call goal management is really task switching or multitasking. And it's how you engage when you have more than one goal, which we know we very frequently do. And so these cognitive control abilities are how we accomplish any goal that we might have. The problem is that there are very fundamental limitations in cognitive control. Our attention, although we could selectively direct it, we cannot very easily distribute it broadly, like casting a net out into the sea. Our working memory has a very limited span. It also has a limited resolution. You don't hold information with the same fidelity as when you first perceived it. Our goal management, our ability to task switch and multitasking is quite limited. We really can't multitask, and I'm going to come back to this later, and parallel process like we might want to. We have to switch, and there's costs with each of those switches. And then along comes our goals. I would say goals are really the pinnacle of human brain evolution. It is really the ability that we have to have very long goals, goals that might be 10 years in the future that are interwoven with other people, interwoven with other goals that most define us as human. I mean, it is really the most unique aspect of how our brains work. And so we set these really amazingly sophisticated goals, and they come and they collide with these limitations. And this creates interference. And this is the core of the distracted mind. There's that little bottom-up signal again. So this is another place where technology has aggravated how we interact in the world. It's not that we didn't always have this conflict. It's just that this is an area where how we interact with information has led us to put pressure on these limitations in a way that we never have before. This is why I say we're ancient brains in a high-tech world. This is an example of it. We have very fundamental limitations that in many ways do not differ that much from other animals, and yet we have these higher-order goals. And so we have this management issue between what we want to do and what we're actually capable of doing. So let's talk about interference. it gets much more complicated. So I'm going to go through this very quickly. I wanted to spend a little time on what we just talked about. But interference can come in many different formats. It could come either internally or externally. And externally, it could come through two different routes. They could be distractions, irrelevant information. So you're at a restaurant, you're trying to have a conversation. All that information around you that's irrelevant that you're trying to ignore, that's distractions. The other type of interference is when you make the decision to engage in more than one activity. So we call those interruptions or multitasking, and that also degrades performance. Now you're at the restaurant, but you're trying to listen to an order at the next table or listen to the specials that you missed the first time and carry on a conversation. And so that's another form of interference. But you don't need external stimuli to have distractions and interruptions. You could do it in your own mind. You can have an event. Maybe you had an altercation with your significant other in the morning, and it's rumbling around your brain, and even though you're having this very important meeting, it pulls your attention just like an external distraction would. We call that mind wandering. Or you might be consciously deciding that while you listen to this, you're going to plan what you're going to have for dinner later, right? So you can multitask and have distraction in numerous ways. And all of this interference can lead to impacts on how we think, our cognition, across every aspect: perception, decision-making, memory, working memory, emotion. And hundreds of labs for a long time have been showing this, including ours. So we have well over a decade of research showing that when you have interference through distraction or interruption, it degrades your memory, your decision-making abilities, even in very, very subtle ways. And I'm not going to break that all down for you right now, but it has an impact on how we think, and then we see that impact on how we behave. Our safety, the obvious one, texting and driving, is almost not even worth talking about. But we know that talking on the phone and driving also increases your risk of accident fourfold, even to the level of drunk driving. If you look at the lowest levels of alcohol that fall into that category, you see similar impact if you do experiments on a simulator. And it's not necessarily just hands-free. It's even just talking on a hands-free device as well. Sleep. We know that devices in the bedroom right before we go to sleep impact both the quality and the quantity of sleep we get. We see impact on relationships. Studies have shown that even the presence of a mobile phone that's not yours, that's a parent, at a table while you're having a conversation degrades your reports of empathy and connection with the person that you're interacting with. Education and work. Tons of data showing that whether the education is happening in a classroom or while you're studying, if you are interrupted, if you are fragmented, you see a decrease in performance, you see an increase in the amount of time it takes to accomplish goals, and you also see an increase in stress and changes in mood. So there's a very, very broad impact that we see for interference, and that's all I'm going to really say on that. But, you know, obviously we have 100 pages devoted to teasing this apart in the book. So let's move on and talk about the brain, where I feel most comfortable. So when it comes to goals and cognitive control, all these things we're talking about, the player is really the prefrontal cortex, the front part of our brain. And this is the most evolved part of our brain. If you look across all these species and you see the amount of brain volume that's occupied by the prefrontal cortex, you see it increases throughout our evolutionary past. And, you know, although monkeys are currently alive, this gives you a reflection of how we evolved in the prefrontal cortex, and not just the volume of it, its connectivity with the rest of the brain. And we see this pattern in another creature, right? We see it during development in children. This slide shows the maturity of the cortex, where the most mature is blue, the cooler colors, and the least mature is red and yellows, the warmer colors. And you can see as you move from age 5 to 20, you see that the blue is not even fully there at 20 years old. Right, so this explains some poor top-down decision-making abilities of even teenagers, and this is really at the core of it, is this ability to have goals, but also to control how we interact with them. We didn't know this for a long time. We knew a lot about the motor cortex, the sensory cortex, but the prefrontal cortex and its function has been elusive. Its first real hint was a case of Phineas Gage. Does anyone know this story, Phineas Gage? Okay, so I'll just run through it briefly. So Phineas Gage, 25 years old, in September 13th, 1848, at 4:30 p.m. in the afternoon, was the foreman in charge of blasting a railroad outside of Cavendish, Vermont. And he had this job of, once a hole was placed, he would put some sand in there, he would put some gunpowder, he'd put a wick, and then he would tamp it in with this device, a tamping iron, 3 feet 7 inches long, 13 and a half pounds. what's been described as an unfortunate spark. Ironically, it's said that maybe he was distracted and did not put the sand in the hole, but a spark occurred, driving the tamping iron up through his face, under his left eye, passing behind his eye, out the right side of his head, landing 80 feet behind him, destroying a good part of his prefrontal cortex. Now, amazingly, he was not killed by this. It's reported that he didn't even lose consciousness, and he was talking soon after and stayed awake and conscious the whole way the cart ride to a local clinic. The amazing thing was that he recovered really well. He did have one infection that put him back, but in the end, he looked like he was doing pretty good. He was able to move. He was able to think. He interacted. And this was feeding a view that the prefrontal cortex really was not that important. But what happened, and this was noted by a really amazing physician that was treating him, was that his personality changed. He was no longer Gage. And I just want to read to you this really beautiful description. He was fitful, irreverent, indulging at times in the grossest profanity, impatient of restraint or advice when it conflicted with his desires, obstinate, devising many plans of operation which are no sooner arranged than they are abandoned in terms for others that are appearing more feasible. The balance between his intellectual faculties and his animal propensities seemed to have been destroyed. It is the distracted mind. He lost cognitive control. He lost that ability to take control of how he interacted with the world and accomplish the goals that he had in a meaningful way. Unfortunately, this was not the last medical case of a distracted mind that was induced by damage. There is a long history known as the frontal lobotomy. I'm sure you probably heard about this. From the 1930s into the 1970s, tens of thousands of people received an operation like this for a whole host of psychiatric conditions, ranging from depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, even anxiety, where the eyelid is lifted up, an ice pick type device like that is inserted, a cut is made, really severing the prefrontal cortex from the rest of the brain, and then the other side is done, leaving this double black eye. Here's a report by this, you know, this was always considered a bit of a controversial procedure, but yet there were still tens of thousands of them. It's amazing, you know, after what we learned from Phineas Gage, this is Walter Freeman writing in 1944. I want to read these descriptions of his patients to you. These patients know that they ought to busy themselves about the house, but they procrastinate. They know that they should be considerate of their relatives and dignified in the presence of strangers, but it's too much trouble. Their interest span is short. They are distractible. The housewife complains of forgetfulness when she's really describing distractibility. A lawyer noted that previous to an operation, he had been able, following an interruption, to resume his dictation at the exact word, whereas afterwards he had to have his secretary read her notes to him before he could resume his trend of thought. Distraction, interruption, written out in that passage. This is before we actually appreciated that the prefrontal cortex did this. Now, due to modern technology and the field of cognitive neuroscience, we know very well how this works. So I'm just going to give you some cartoons. We have probably 30 papers that tease apart how this occurs. But essentially, when it comes to distraction, I would say your prefrontal cortex is like a bouncer. It's deciding what information is on the list. And then the visual cortex, like a dinner party. It's not like a crazy party, only let like six pieces of information in there. And if the bouncer does not do his job here of filtering that information, there's a cost. And that cost is a degradation of performance. And we see that all the time. It is not just our goals to pay attention and focus, even though we think that's what we're doing. It's also equally our goal to filter out the distraction is around us. And we know this is undeveloped in children. We know this is impaired in all these neurological and psychiatric diseases that have attention deficits. And we know that it declines, even with healthy aging. And I'll show you how extreme that is in a little while. In terms of multitasking, now the prefrontal cortex is acting more like a flight controller, determining what the priority is at this moment. And so if you're doing something insane, like a bike messenger in New York, and you're texting while driving next to a cab, biking, you know, your prefrontal cortex might be directing your attention to the traffic and then flip over to the text. But what it does not do is this. There is a bottleneck. This is why people describe the myth of multitasking. You feel like you're multitasking, but what you're really doing is switching networks between these two goals. If the goals are attention demanding, unlike chewing gum, let's say, then the prefrontal cortex really engages in one network at a time, has to move between them. And with each move, even if you're not aware of it, there's a cost. There's a cost in terms of time, and there's a cost in terms of performance. And so that's what's going on in our brain. So now let's try to see what we can do about it, right? So you can't just tell a story like that and leave it there. You guys would be totally miserable if I just left it at that point. So I spent a lot of time thinking about this idea of how do we take control, right, of our cognitive control? How do we flip this story around, right? We don't want to get rid of technology. We can't get rid of technology, nor should we. It's amazing. It does incredible things in our lives. So there's really two ways that we could take control. One is that we can modify our behavior, and the other is that we can enhance our brain. Right, and not like in this horrifying way over here. I just thought that was a really cool picture, but I think we could do it in a less extreme manner. Okay, let's talk about modifying our behavior. Before we talk about modifying behavior, we haven't really talked about why we really behave in this way, and I think the reason is deeper than we've heard before. And so this is a new hypothesis that's presented in the book. And it starts with understanding squirrels. Okay? Squirrels forage in a very particular way for food. They forage in what's known as a patchy environment. They go into a tree, they eat seeds like you're seeing here, and at some point, they decide that they should move on to the next tree. Right? This is the exploit versus explore interaction of an animal with their environment. And there are many mathematical theories that have been devised, they're called optimal foraging theories, that describe behaviors of predator-prey, of animals that forage in patchy environments like squirrels. And so what I started thinking about was, could we adopt one of these models to human behavior? Since I already told you that there is a school of thought that we really use the same reward systems that other animals use when they forage for food. And so I looked at this theory here, known as the marginal value theory. This is a heavy theory, lots of math involved, but I'm just going to take you through a figure, and I think it'll make sense. And I think what you'll find is that we behave in a very similar way to other animals that forage in patchy environments. That patchy environment might be you at your computer, it might be you on your phone, it might be you on a website, depends how you define the patch. But you're in there getting that information is feeding you. So let's step through this figure. If you look along the y-axis, that's the cumulative resource intake. You want to go up in there. That means that you're getting more resources, whether it be food or information. To the right side on the x-axis is the benefits, and the left side is the cost. So what's the benefits? The benefits is how much value you gain by staying in whatever patch you're in at the moment. And the cost is the time it takes to get to the next source. So a squirrel might decide at some point that they want to move on or they stay. This is the decision they have to make. How does that occur? It occurs because over time, there's a resource intake curve that has diminishing value. As they eat more and more seeds, there are less seeds. So it starts off amazing, and then it gets less and less good. They know how far it is to the next tree. They have an estimated time. Like if the next tree was miles away, they'd probably eat every single seed on that tree. So they know. They have the cost of how long it's going to take them to go there. If you look at the intersection, draw a tangent between these, and drop a line, you wind up with the optimal time that an animal will stay in its source. And this has been used to predict all sorts of animal behaviors pretty accurately in the laboratory and out in the field. So if you think about this from the human perspective, we are also in a source getting information. We know how much value we're getting in there, have some estimate of the value of being here. And we also know how long it's going to take us to get to the next information source. So this is where I say technology has challenged us, because what we have found is that there is an increase in the boredom that we experience when engaging in activities and an increase in the anxiety that we have by missing out on something else, right? FOMO, probably familiar with that. So, you know, and this is a long story. Why are we more bored? Maybe the way that we are constantly being rewarded by switching all the time, whether it's in texting or video games. But it does seem that boredom is accumulating, and anxiety, because of maybe, you know, probably a big impact of social media, and the data would suggest that there's so much going on that we should know about that's so important. This leads to a decrease in the curve, so I'm going to step through this, which drives the time we stay in the source to a lower time. Then on the other side, we have an increase in accessibility of more information. Just one link away, or reach into your pocket, or look on the next screen, or go to the next tab, and you have more information. What this does is drive the time down and drives the optimal time to us less. And so we are constantly being driven by technology just through our core goal of seeking out information to move more and more frequently. And that's why you see so many devices in our hands. We're just driven for this. So the reason I spent a lot of time thinking about this and how we could have a framework is because we need a framework in order to change our behavior. So now that we have a framework, we could propose pretty straightforward. I mean, the solution might be more difficult, how we would change our behavior. The first thing we could do is decrease accessibility, right? That will drive the curve away, make us stay there longer. We can also decrease boredom and anxiety, and that will drive it longer. So this is the idea that we can take these cues from the marginal value theorem and use it to conduct how we interact in the world in a better way to improve our behavior and improve our quality of life. So how do we do that? This is a tricky part for me because one thing I do not want to be is like some self-help guru. And I really avoid that. I probably do an interview with the press every single day. And, you know, we get into this issue of, well, what should people do? And I don't necessarily feel comfortable telling people what to do, but I can tell you what I do. So I've been working on this for a long time, thinking about it, and I have modified my own behavior and a lot of it in accord with that theorem that I just presented. So the first step of modifying behavior is what we call metacognition. It's understanding that there's a problem that needs to be fixed. That is not enough to fix it, right? We know how bad smoking is, sun exposure. We engage in many behaviors all the time that we know are bad for us. But you do have to start with knowledge. You have to be motivated to change. So hopefully I shared a lot of that with you, why we're very limited in this capacity. And then you can structure your life to decrease the accessibility as well as the boredom and anxiety you feel. Accessibility, work in a cleaner space. If you are engaged in something very important, and a really critical thing that I like to stress is does not mean that multitasking is bad. It's not bad or good. It's just that you make an informed decision based on your understanding and then engage in it at the appropriate time. There's hours that I'll multitask in a row. If it's of low importance, if it doesn't have a time stamp on it, multitask away. It's more fun, more rewarding. You're more likely to do things that you might not otherwise accomplish. But when you have to do something at a very high level, we know that the best way to do it is to give it singular focused attention. And so quitting your email program, not just minimizing it, at least that's what I find, closing your door, turning your phone to airplane mode, really locking in when you have to get something done. This is not a very comfortable place to be. You will find that very quick. You should try it tomorrow. We have definitely, I think, become very accustomed to a new style of interacting with our world. And these things, boredom and anxiety, accumulate. You can feel them accumulate. So how do we deal with that? Now, this is, I think, even more complicated than the accessibility issue. The first point that I would say is that there is nothing wrong with being bored. Right? We have no tolerance to be bored. You can't even wait online, right, at a shopping center for 3 minutes without seeking out information. But when we are bored, when we allow our minds to wander, there's a lot of creativity that can occur in those moments and connections that we're often deprived of. So boredom is okay. It's okay to be bored. It's okay to be stressed. It's okay to be hungry. We can learn to tolerate some of these things if they're reasonable. Same thing with anxiety. I would say the key to dealing with it, especially as you move forward, is to set breaks. Breaks are critical, right? The exercise world knows this very well. Interval training, it's sort of like interval training. You have to give yourself breaks. Now, not all breaks are created equal. If your break is to check your email, that's not a good one, right? So take a break where you get exercise, physical exercise. Take a break where you're exposed to nature. Take a break where you meditate or think deeply about one thing that's different from what you're working on. If you take a walk, make sure you don't, walk past a million people and engage in a lot of conversation. Just have time to relax if you're working on this critical assignment. Same thing with anxiety. Setting up boundaries and expectations from other people. If you're in an open office space, complicated issue. I just had a piece in Fast Company yesterday, and it was very complicated because we know how many open office spaces there are, especially around here, and they're great, right? There's such an amazing way to exchange and connect. But when you're trying to get something done, it's hard for the reasons I described. So some friends that I talk to will have like a cone that they put on their desk that means like 11 to 2. You see this cone? Don't come talking to me. Deal with your own problem for now. You can get back to me at 2 o'clock. Noise cancellation, headphones send quite a message just like they do on an airplane. And we have a whole list of other suggestions. But basically, this is the goal. Everyone has to work out in their own way. But I think that if you figure it out, even for part of the day, you'll see that just like running, you know, if you're training for a marathon, it just sucks, right? It's so hard. And then you get over this hurdle. If you go to the gym, you work through, and then you see value in a place that you only saw anguish, right? And so you can learn how to interact with the world in this way, not all the time. And I think you'll get a lot of value. All right, so let's talk about enhancing our brain, which I spend a lot more time thinking about because this is a big focus of what my center at UCSF does. So I'm just going to do this really quickly, take us through the landscape of approaches. This is a lot, and we could tease it apart an hour just with this slide. The first thing are ways that we interact with the world. Experiences shape our brain. Education is supposed to do this, right? One of the goals of education should be to improve how our minds focus, not just to transmit information. And maybe we've gone astray there, and this could be historically placed, how education really grew out of the Industrial Revolution, where people had to be educated with facts and information and skills. But we should also be thinking about it as a tool to improve how our brains function, how our cognitive control abilities allow us to engage in the way we want to. Cognitive exercises, video games, I'm going to come back and talk about that more. Meditation falls in the same category, and exposure to nature. These are ways that we interact in the world, and there's evidence across all of them to various degrees. All of them need more evidence, I could say that firmly, in order to move them into everyday practice. But I think that there's good reasons for all of these things being tools that you can use to strengthen your brain and decrease the limitations of cognitive control. We know that things that are just generally good for our bodies that we've learned for a long time are also good for our distracted minds. Physical exercise, nutrition, stress management, and sleep maintenance. These things are critical, and we could go on and on about them. The top of the list is physical exercise in terms of evidence. I think it's like malpractice for a physician, a psychiatrist, or a neurologist to not tell a patient that's suffering any type of impairment, whether it be depression, anxiety, memory, attention problem, to not physically exercise. I mean, this is just critical for brain health, especially in this domain. You could take pills, right? So this is another possible approach, small molecules. All of these mentioned here, just in case you can't read them, Ritalin, Adderall for ADHD, modafinil for narcolepsy and jet lag, and Aricept for Alzheimer's disease are all neurotransmitter receptory altering agents that have some degree of evidence that they improve cognitive control. We know that these are used not just in the clinical setting, right? College students around, certainly around the U.S., engage in massive amount of use of those top drugs of Adderall, Ritalin. The evidence is a lot less convincing that they are helpful in people that are healthy, and they are not off the charts, change your brain type of agents. So I think that given the side effect profile and the addictive aspects, this is not a really good alternative for this type of goal. But it's on the list. Neurofeedback needs more evidence, but interesting, and I'll tell you how our group is approaching that. And then things that seem a little more science fiction-y, like brain stimulation, either through the scalp or by implantable electrodes, have also shown benefits in improving cognitive control. So that's the landscape. There's a lot of things, a massive amount of research around the world going on to help us have better tools to improve cognitive control. Okay. Let's switch gears a bit. My message is not that technology is evil. I am not a Luddite, if you know me at all. I love technology. I think that actually we have the opportunity to use technology as a way of alleviating a lot of the limitations of cognitive control, thus helping our distracted minds. How is that possible? We have so much new technology emerging into the consumer space, virtual reality, augmented reality, wearable physiological devices, artificial intelligence, motion capture. Most of these things are positioned in the consumer domain, right? Entertainment tools, communication, and media. How about if these could be reimagined and tested and designed as approaches to improving our cognition? How is that even possible? The answer is actually not that complicated. It's because these technologies and all the other ones that you already have, most of you have on you, can be used to create experiences. An experience is the gateway to our brain's plasticity, right? This is a very powerful point. It is the entire basis of learning. plasticity, this wondrously complex dance of change that occurs in every one of our brains at every moment. We're changing the structure, the chemistry, the function, all in response to experience. We know how powerful this experience in induction of plasticity is, right? You can have a distracted mind produced by one horrible experience, right? We call that post-traumatic stress disorder. You could witness a devastating event, not even just get shrapnel in your brain, a different form of traumatic brain injury, and impact in a negative way the functioning of your brain for the rest of your life, and a decrease in cognitive control are like the main symptoms of having a traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder. So if an experience can induce that type of change and lead to that type of effect, then it seems that one of the goals are how do we leverage or create new technologies to maximally harness our brain's plasticity so that we can enhance our cognition, refine our behavior, and alleviate a lot of these challenges we have in the world. And so that's what I want to talk about a little bit. How we do that in our group is we create closed-loop systems. And so this is the core of everything that we focus on in our group right at UCSF. A closed loop is where you intervene in some way, in any way, and you record the impact. You quantify it with as low latency as possible, so ideally in real time. So you intervene, you record. You use that data to refine your intervention based on what you're learning to optimize it. So if you didn't get as much of an effect as you wanted, you increase it a little bit. If you got too much of an effect, you back away. You apply it, you record it, you refine. You cycle over and over again. At each pass, you're personalizing and optimizing that intervention. This is how you change any system. Every engineer knows this. This is not how our education or our medicine system work at all now. You take a drug, you go home, months pass, you subjectively monitor your effects, your side effects, you go back, and then the doctor's like, oh, I'm going to go up or down a little bit. Right? That's the art of medicine. This is a completely ineffective way to change something as complex as the human brain. So we build closed-loop systems in our lab. It's not the only way, but I think it's the most effective way, through creating video games. Video games are a powerful form of interactive media. They have immersion, engagement, fun as factors, in addition to the ability to create really effective closed-loop systems. So here's an example of how we do that. So there's your brain on the left side. You're playing a video game. Your brain is active, of course, and that guides your behavior, which can be recorded as performance metrics, how fast you are, how accurate you are. The software can record all of this data essentially in real time and then use it to feed back to you an environment that's appropriately challenged to your ability in that moment. So when you come in on day one, whether you're 8 or 80 years old, the game will calibrate to you so you're in a comfortable space, actually the ideal space for engaging and having fun. And then because of plasticity, as you get better over time, the game constantly baby steps into a more advanced challenge, like a personal trainer there every single second. The other thing we could do in real time is give you feedback, how you're doing. Every game designer in the world knows this is how you create engagement, deep engagement. I think engagement is critical to something like a game to change your brain in the way that we've been talking about. Then we could bring in our other technology, like motion capture and all those physiological devices that, for the most part, yield almost completely unactionable data. How about if that data was fed into a game system like this so that it was not just adjusting its challenge to how fast or accurate you are, but to what's happening in your brain, what's happening in terms of your heart rate, your autonomic responses, how you're moving. And then we now have the ability to create even more real-world immersive environments through virtual reality and augmented reality, overlaying it on the real world itself. Then we could wrap all of this together with sophisticated machine learning algorithms and create this truly integrated multimodal closed-loop system. This is, you know, a very sort of futuristic, but not so far away. We are engaged in experiments on every single aspect of this, on how we can improve cognitive control abilities, that core of what leads to this distraction. So I want to make this a little less abstract and bring it back to the distracted mind in a deeper way. 8 years ago, I asked myself this question. Could we create a custom-designed video game that used closed-loop algorithms, like I just described to you, to improve cognitive control in older adults? So you've seen all these, attention, working memory, goal management. They all get worse as we get older. And I'm not just talking about Alzheimer's disease and other causes of dementia. All aging leads to a decline in cognitive control. More distracted minds occur as we get older. I had the hypothesis that because we know that these are related mechanistically through a lot of research from our lab and others, if we challenged one aspect of it in a closed loop, like multitasking, goal management, could we see a benefit in attention and working memory? Right? So these are all related to each other. That is the goal. Train on one thing and see improvements in others. And so I reached out to friends of mine that worked at the Presidio at a company called LucasArts, and I had a design for a game, a multitasking game that I asked their help in developing so that we could use it as a training program to improve the distracted mind of older adults, which we've been studying for a decade. And so this is how NeuroRacer works. You drive a car on a road going left, right, as the road moves, going up, and then you have to respond as rapidly and accurately to these target signs, like green circles, not red circles, not green pentagons, which are very hard not to respond to. And so you're moving through this task with both of the challenges being adapted based on your abilities. And then we tie them together with a reward cycle. One thing we learn is that everyone, including 80-year-olds, want to level up in video games. It's just like some core part of being a human being. And so we take advantage of that, that everyone wants to see that progress, that improvement over time. And this is what we created. We created this game, NeuroRacer. And then we did a multi-year study to see how it works. And so what you're looking at here on the top is 0%, meaning that that is the best you can multitask. You just can't get any better. You don't suffer any decrement. If you look at 20-year-olds, you see that there's a 27% drop in performance when you multitask, despite the fact that 20-year-olds in San Francisco believe they are multitasking masters, right? 20-year-olds are just convinced about this. If you look across the lifespan, you don't see that this ability maintains itself only to like plummet in one tragic year when you're 70. You see the plummet every single tragic year of your life, right? You see this decline right across your life, all the way to 63% decrement when you're in your 80s. We also challenged our game designers to record brain activity during gameplay so we could see what is occurring. And we looked at a measure from the prefrontal cortex known as midline frontal theta and showed that in 20-year-olds you get this really robust burst. I won't really dive into the details of data for time, but you could see that yellow is this burst of activity right at the most challenging part of the game. It occurs within a third of a second after a sign comes up while you're driving. If we look at older adults, there's a burst there, but it's certainly not at the same level. And then we brought another group of older adults back, and we had them train on the multitasking version of the game for 12 hours, 1 hour a day, 3 days a week for 4 weeks. We brought them back, and this is what we found. Their ability to multitask was massively improved. You could see that red dot. They were engaging their prefrontal cortex more robustly, more rapidly, more complete networks in the brain were engaged. And we found that 6 months later, after not playing the game, we preserved this ability to multitask. But most importantly, we confirmed our hypothesis. We showed that their working memory and their ability to do an attention span task, other aspects of cognitive control, also improved, as well as what they trained in the task. And we published this in 2013 in this journal in Nature, and you know, it's a really exciting part of a lab's history to have a paper in this journal. And what, you know, the takeaway to us is not that this game is a game changer, although we're happy with the results, but that this methodology, that you could work with a team of scientists and professionals from another industry like the video game world to build something that neither group can do alone, and then to do a very careful, well-controlled study, this is necessary if we're going to move an entertainment tool like video games into the therapeutic domain. So this is the approach that we want to see more of. We have a company, I'm not going to talk about all this, called Achille, that grew out of that research and now has a game, a much higher level, called Project Evo, that is not available in the consumer space. You cannot download this on the App Store. This game is in multiple clinical trials, PTSD, autism, traumatic brain injury, anxiety disorder, Alzheimer's disease, multiple sclerosis starting, and just started a multi-site trial as a FDA-approved treatment for children with ADHD. So we'll know as soon as next year whether we have the first FDA-approved prescribable video game and the first non-pharmaceutical treatment for ADHD. So that'll be exciting. So there we go. Maybe we'll fix it. Thank you. I just want to conclude by saying that just probably like a mile and a half from here, we have a new center called Neuroscape, which is the evolution of what our lab has become, and really trying to ultimately bridge this world of technology and neuroscience for positive impact and help our distracted minds in many different ways. This is an example of one of our technologies known as the glass brain, where we can actually look inside the brain, see distraction happening in the moment, and try to use that data to create even more powerful interventions. All right, this is my last slide. I just want to conclude with a flashback to these two powerful ways that we interact with the world where we're challenged. And most importantly, while we wait for all that new technology, what do we do? There's really five pillars of brain health in my mind. physical exercise being the very top in terms of evidence, cognitive challenge, constantly pushing ourselves. Until these tools are available, travel, learning new musical instruments, languages, just engaging in a rich social world, critical for keeping our brains healthy. Nutrition, stress management, not that no stress, some stress is good, but not overwhelming stress that's helpless stress. And of course, sleep. More and more data all the time that sleep is absolutely critical for keeping our brains healthy. So with that, I want to conclude and thank you for your attention.
They wrote me a note saying, don't forget to turn on the microphone. I guess that's... So we have some questions and answers from the audience that we'll take, and then we'll see how far we get on those. So this question is, what do we know about the impact of technology on a child's mind, both positive and negative?
Oh, these are long answers, and I know we have a lot of questions. I could tell you that it is very complicated, and we don't know a lot because technology is changing so rapidly. And a lot of the answers that we really want are based on longitudinal studies where we look at change over time. We don't really have great data like that. We have correlational data, and a lot of it would suggest that we have an acute problem of using multiple forms of technology, especially during the act of studying and especially during the act of learning in a classroom. So I think that the challenge that the people in this room feel, which is probably why you come to a lecture called The Distracted Mind in the first place, or pick up a book of that title, and no one is immune from this, is worse for kids. We do not have the high level development of the prefrontal cortex. Cognitive control abilities are already lower. Same thing on the opposite end of the life spectrum, as I showed you. So there are challenges in front of us, and we don't know all the answers, and it is only getting more complicated. But of course, technology has done wonderful things and creates incredible learning opportunities. So, you know, like everything yin-yang, it's really much more complicated than you could describe in a moment. You have to figure out the right balance.
Okay. Information, knowledge, wisdom. Different parts of the brain, and then there is a second part. It's actually different, but if your goal is to always be totally present, does your brain conflict with that?
Okay, my brain's trying to interpret both of those questions at the same time. I wish you could have just told me one.
And then,
I'm just going to focus on that first one. Okay. I'm going to single task here.
I thought
here.
The wisdom aspect of that was interesting.
I mean, yeah, wisdom is something that I find fascinating. I'll lump in that in with that compassion. These are things I think a lot about. It's an influence of a friend of mine, Jack Kornfield, who's a real master in the mindfulness domain. And we have a video game that we worked on together called Metatrain to try to help improve self-regulation of internal distraction. And he's now always encouraging me to think about things like wisdom and compassion, which I think the world needs now more than ever, it seems. And when you look at such complex aspects of the brain like that or knowledge, you really wind up with a very challenging time to quantify a lot of it. We think that a lot of the solutions, are really in two directions. One is building just the strength of a brain to be able to pay better attention and to focus. This whole distracted mind issue does not help our compassion and empathy problem. And so there's like, in some ways, a bottom-up approach. Build a stronger brain so you could deal with more sophisticated issues. And then you come from the opposite side where you look at very complex, dynamic behaviors across populations that emerge amongst many interactions. So we need to be, very sophisticated in how we approach it. But I think it is such a critical, issue and one that we want to spend a lot more time on. And there's a second question that I have no idea what it is.
What if your goal is to be always present, is to be totally present? Does the brain conflict with that?
Well, I think that's, a lot of what I was trying to discuss, that act, what we call sustained or focused attention, is difficult. It doesn't come for free. It requires energy and resources. And it's also the type of thing that needs to be practiced. And you can lose that as a skill. And a lot of us might have lost that to a degree that we might have had better at one time. And going back to the question about children, let's say you never develop that skill, that might be a big problem. So I think that, you know, that's sort of my message, if there is one here. It's that the value of single tasking is not to be underestimated, and to become a better single tasker is an act of effort and practice and patience.
Okay. What direction would you like to see this field of study be going in 5 years?
You know, I'll have to pick my own direction because, you know, that's what I do every day. You know, again, there's lots of ways of looking at this. There's both the behavior and the brain part of it. You can't just change a brain and expect it to engage in the world better. There's a lot of other factors besides your brain that dictate how you interact. So I think, you know, what I would like to see the field do is really give the due and appropriate attention to both behavior modification, interacting with improving brain function. And, you know, probably as a group we'll focus a lot, you know, everyone has to pick a focus area. We'll focus more on improving the brain, but that has to intersect with this other world. And then we do have to think about technology in a healthier way. I really think that that is the challenge that we face now. We can't just, you know, voraciously consume it just because it's so tasty. We have to slow down and use it in a better, healthier way. And, you know, we've gotten a lot of attention with this book just coming out a couple weeks ago, and more so than I expected. And I think it's because people feel the burden in their lives, or they see it in their kids or their parents, or, you know, so how do we not abandon technology but just make it more of an asset to us is where I'd like to see us spend more time.
Is there a specific nutritional diet that enhances attention span?
The nutritional data is challenging, and Patty has a lot of background in nutrition herself. It's challenging because it's really hard to do the type of randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled studies that practitioners in the medical world depend upon. It doesn't mean that there's not value. That's just really difficult. I would say the best evidence in terms of the distracted mind and nutrition would fall on what's known as the Mediterranean diet. And some of that might be because it got, you know, attention of great researchers that really did some meaningful studies. But you're probably familiar with it, right? Fish and legumes and oils and white wine. Red wine is on that list. Everyone's always excited about that one. So you do see some benefits in there in terms of these type of processes and benefits on aging, but we definitely need more data to help us guide the right recipe to keep the brain healthy.
And if I may, on that note, yes, if you're in Italy and you know you take siestas, right? Well, you take their lifestyle comes into play with their diet.
That's true
as well.
Too. And you see, this is why nutrition studies are so complicated in that way. That's one, you know, there's a lot of factors that go on. It's really hard to control. And, you know, there the aspect of, you know, we already talked about it, but it's hard to not being triggered by nutrition to also think of stress and sleep management. I mean, all these things come together. That those are the things that we need. You know, we're all driven people that want to be successful, and there's no reason that we have to compromise that. As a matter of fact, I think we'll be more successful. We'll certainly be happier. But thinking about how to juggle all those five elements, nutrition being one of them, is so important.
How about longer-term distractions like context switching at work over a period of minutes or hours? Do they function in the same way?
So the data would suggest that whether you're looking at students that are home studying or workers, largely the studies have been done on IT workers, that people tend to engage in a task for 2 to 5 minutes before they're interrupted. That interruption is just as likely to occur by something that seems completely internal than something external. So it might not be that you got a text. You might just, oh, time to check email. And so we have a lot of internal interruptions that occur as well. And then you move back to a task. But the challenge is that time could be very long because, you know, there's a cascade of events that sometimes are triggered by an interruption. And this has been shown to have an impact on the productivity of the business itself, just in terms of dollars, and then an impact on productivity of the person as well as stress and mood. So, yeah, we do see a lot of insane amounts of switching in the workplace.
I'm really curious as to how you're going to answer this one.
Oh, great.
Are you familiar with ego death in the context of deep meditation? Also, what are your thoughts on microdosing known hallucinogens in the context of treating mental illness?
No ESP questions from this audience? No, I didn't mean to put them together. I just got a funny ESP question once.
I love that.
Yes, I have heard of that, largely through Jack, the ego death question. My wife and I, we spent 10 days in silence at Spirit Rock last year. Talk about a challenge for a distracted mind. We could spend an hour just talking about that experience and how I viewed it. But, there is these stages that you go through as you focus internally on what's going on in your mind and limit information that comes in, and you feel it pretty rapidly, and it's a pretty powerful experience. So, these are ancient practices that have, countless thousands of years of anecdote and really impressive research studies showing that meditation and other mindfulness practices, which are essentially attention exercises at their core, can take you through all these multiple stages where you transform how you think, and that being one example. Microdosing of what? I sort of missed the
hallucinogens. Yeah.
Someone's like,
now we know.
Sounds like, I love that. I don't know much about it. Let's just say that. No, I really don't know. I don't know. I'm going to take a pass on that one. I'm allowed to pass. I don't know.
Okay. Just two more questions. We were going to stop and then have additional questions, but some of these questions have already been answered during the presentation. So two more questions, and then we have time. Then we'll go out to the lobby out there, and so you can all buy the book and have them sign it for you. So here's the next question. Two more. How do our emotions come into this cognitive overdrive in response to technology? Don't our emotions affect us too?
Yeah, so of course, and this is the challenge of giving such a dense talk in a short period of time. When I use cognition, I equally include emotional regulation in there. To me, it's just another aspect of cognition, at least how I view it, that you manage your attention, your autonomic responses, your emotional reactions is all part of cognitive control. We have a study right now where we use our multitasking game, Evo, and the data, not published yet, but the data really suggests that it can impact depression and really not just cognition, but actually the mood elements of it. So these things are, intricately interwoven, emotion and cognition, and I didn't mean to separate or mean that it's any less important. It's incredibly complex.
Okay, and then the last question, how do we focus when there's a prominent internal distraction that keeps constantly coming back? That's a good one.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that one. No, it's, look, there are going to be times that you are so distracted that you just have to bow out of what you're doing and recognize the fact that you're distracted and you can't accomplish what you need to. I remember I had a horrible experience with that during 9/11. I was a neurologist on call at a children's hospital doing rounds, and every, TV set is on the same channel. My family lives in New York City, and then, they realized that it was upsetting everyone for good reason, and so they turned off the televisions, and I couldn't do rounds. I had to just bow out and ask someone else to take over. And our minds are very powerful, and sometimes we have control of them and sometimes we don't. I think the best thing is being better, more aware of your internal space and making those decisions. Sometimes you might have to pull your car over, not just because of external distractions, but internal distractions. So I feel like a lot of us don't give our internal world the same due respect that we do things on the outside, but we do have to understand that they could influence us in incredibly powerful and dangerous ways. You take this to the extreme. This is the entire basis of PTSD. And a lot of the symptoms in depression as well, and OCD. Like, this internal rumination is incredibly powerful and can be completely debilitating. So, it's part of the distracted mind issue, and there's not necessarily a remedy to it, whether it's on the light level or on the truly clinical. But being aware of it in yourself and others and how they might be dealing with it is really important.
Okay. Well, I'm going to use this as a gavel. Let's hope it doesn't break. So, okay. Our thanks to Dr. Ghazali for his program here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.